Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name's Claire Clark. I'm one of the hosts of the channel. And today we're talking to David Hardin, the author of Standpipe, Delivering Water in Flint. David Hardin is a Michigan poet, a writer, and artist. He's the author of two books of poetry, and his work has appeared in Three Quarks Daily, Drunken Boat, Bear River Review, the Michigan Quarterly Review, and many other outlets. Dave, welcome to the show.
Hi, Claire. Thanks for having me. I really I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I wonder if you could begin our interview with our traditional opening question, which is telling our listeners just a little bit about yourself and your career trajectory up until this point.
Sure. I worked as a special education teacher in Michigan for 30 years. And I worked with adults with developmental disabilities, emotional disabilities, mental illness, the whole gamut. And I retired from that a few years ago. And since that time, I, for lack of a better way of putting it, I've been working on me. I got into art, painting primarily, and I have a studio practice that I still am involved in. And I got into writing. And writing is something that I had been drawn to early on, but for various reasons, I got away from it for a long time, and I had the good fortune to be able to investigate it again after I retired.
And how did you come to write Standpipe? Because it's a little bit different than some of the writing you had published previously, I think.
Yeah, I primarily, I'm a poet primarily. And when I say poet, I didn't train as a poet. I don't come from an academic literary tradition. But I've always been, I was drawn to that. And intuitively, I think I love language. I love rhythm and imagery. So Standpipe is a departure from what I normally write. But I think the fact that I write poetry really informed the writing of Standpipe. Looking at it now, I can see parallels between the kind of poetry that I write and some of the passages in Standpipe, some of the chapters.
I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how you sort of literally came to write Standpipe. How tell us about the circumstances that you drew from in writing this book.
I had no intention of writing a book about this anyway. Writing a book I'm like a lot of people, you know, I've always entertained, fantasized about writing a book. I had published two books of poetry, but writing a book proper was something I aspired to, but really I couldn't quite imagine doing it. But the book came about directly from my decision to volunteer with the American Red Cross the height of the Flint water crisis. I had been listening to reports on my local public radio station for months and months and months, and following the progress, but really only half-heartedly. I had other things. There were other things occupying my time, I'll get to that as well. But in the spring of, gosh, I hope I have the date right. In the spring of 16, the early spring, the water crisis was sort of full blown, and it was in Michigan, at least, I think probably nationwide, it was in the news every day. And I became convinced that I needed to go there. I needed to go to Flint and to do something to help out. And I hadn't really been an activist of any kind. I'm pretty vocal about things, but I hadn't really taken an activist role. So it was a first for me. And I guess I should say at this point, the reason I decided, what got me fired up to go, was my mother had died the fall of 15, and almost not long after she died, I underwent some routine surgery. It kept me, immobile for a couple of months, so I had time on my hands, and found myself stewing, kind of isolated, the way we all are right now, I guess, in the pandemic, and grieving my mother. Although I didn't understand what I was going through so much, and when this opportunity came up to volunteer, in hindsight, I realized I was channeling my grief, my rage. In a way that I think, you know, turned out to be healthy and productive. But at the time, I just wanted to go and physically do something. So I went, I drove to Flint. I live in outside of Detroit. Flint is about 70 miles north of where I live. I drove there one day without much of a plan, other than I knew that I had to go to the Red Cross. And one thing led to another, and I enrolled in a training program there to become a disaster relief volunteer, which is there. It's the portal at the Red Cross to provide relief services anywhere in the nation after primarily a natural disaster, but. In this case, the disaster was very unnatural, and it was brought about by human error and hubris, in my opinion. Anyway, I having gone through that training, I started to go to Flint every week, and I make the point in the book. There were people who were doing this very thing daily, and it, that wasn't me. I was going once a week, and I went for about 5 months. So I wasn't one of the people who really, sacrificed a great deal of time to make a difference in Flint. But I was going there regularly. I wasn't living there. I was driving back and forth on the days that I volunteered. I found over time that it took me some time to realize why I had gone there in the first place, and what my expectations were, what I expected to find there, my rationale was pretty rudimentary in the beginning. I wanted to feel like I was physically engaged and doing something to help people who are obviously in need of help. I'm rambling. I hope I've answered the question.
Yes. Absolutely. I'm going to back up just a little bit and ask you to. So this book for our listeners is a memoir, in case that hasn't been made clear. It's not sociology. It's not history. It's not journalism. Right. It's not journalism either. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the structure of this book? Could you give us a summary? This is a hard book to summarize, but if you can, could you give us a summary?
Yeah, I think I can. I'll try. Again, it wasn't, there are plenty of really good journalistic books that have come out about Flint and magazine articles and newspaper articles. I didn't have anything to add in that realm. But my book is a memoir, and it's a memoir of my time in Flint over the course of months. But it also weaves in the story of my family of origin, particularly my mother. And the lead up, the origins of the crisis in Flint go back to 2014 and probably before that. It didn't erupt into a full blown emergency. It took time to happen, and a lot of things conspired to make that happen. My mother had entered a period of decline that more or less paralleled the lead up to the water crisis in Flint. Again, I live in Michigan. My parents had been native Tennesseans, if that's the right word, Tennesseans. Mm-hmm. They came to Michigan, like a lot of people after the World War II, to find work, and they stuck around. They stayed until they reached retirement age, and ultimately, they went to Florida, like a lot of people, in retirement. But then my father died, and my mother wound up going back to her hometown in Tennessee, East Tennessee, in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains. So I only saw her periodically. We kept in touch over the phone, and we would see each other once or twice a year. But in her decline, I found myself, going there quite often, with increasing frequency to see to her her medical needs, and along with my brother. I grew up with a brother as well, and so he was part of that too. I'm going to collect my thoughts here real quick and backtrack. Mm-hmm. My mother, and the book talks a lot about our early relationship. I was the first born in my family, and my brother came along 5 years afterward. And the circumstances of our family were that my father had a job that took him away from home for lengthy periods of time. And so it was just the two of us, and we were very close. We had us against the world, I guess, at the time. She didn't know anybody in Michigan and had no family, no friends to speak of. So she and I spent a lot of time together, and that closeness over time started to erode. I hope it comes out in the book. It's complicated why that happened, but we drifted apart, and it was probably more not so much drifting as we ran away from each other. And it was only in her at the end of her life that I realized how important she was to me, and that I, in fact, needed her. at my age, I was in my late 50s at the time, and I realized that I very much needed her, maybe more than she needed me. So that's how those two stories come together. And then I went to Flint after her death, and everything I'm describing to you wasn't apparent to me at the time. It came out through the writing. It came out over time. There were many things about our relationship that took time to bubble up. I think all I knew at the time I went to Flint was I was angry. I was full of rage. I would have said at the time that it was directed toward, you know, mainly toward the situation in Flint and how that came to be, you know, decisions that were made in Lansing and by the city manager that had been appointed by the governor. But a lot of it was my own, you know, rage directed and anger directed, you know, having to do with my family situation and how we seemed to get off track.
So the book really it sort of flashes back and forth between your relationship with your mother and her decline, and then your work in the city of Flint. Could you tell us a little? Go ahead.
Maybe you were going to ask me this. I was going to say that in the beginning, what I started doing in Flint while I was there, I realized that I was a very small part of something big. And I set out to preserve what I saw and what I heard every day in a journal. And I did so without an intention of turning that into a book. But I think it was the people that I met every day. I met a lot on my days there. I met a lot of people in the course of handing out water or delivering water, and I became very curious about them, and I wanted to preserve conversations and my impressions and you know, the setting in which they occurred. So what began to grow was a journal, but I wanted to avoid, and I purposely set out to avoid a linear kind of a day-to-day, this happened on this day, then the next day this happened. I almost saw it as a cut and paste affair where mirrored my experience there. You know, it would almost be when I would show up in Flint on a particular day, it would almost be, it didn't necessarily connect with what I had done the week before or what I would do the week after. Every day stood alone. And I wanted to, in the beginning, at least, set out to create develop a journal feel to it, but that didn't really track in a linear way. If that makes sense. Yeah. I had research. My research of the Flint situation. Again, this was not a journalistic endeavor. I went back and I read accounts for contemporary accounts of the lead up to the crisis in magazine articles. My personal research was really the sum total of work that I had been doing on my own for years, mainly after I retired, my own developing my own insight into how I got to be who I was. And I had done some writing for my own, just for me, that never, with no intention of publishing it, trying to put down my story. And I drew quite a bit from that in the writing of the book.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Can you talk a bit about the writing of the book? I think people who have never written memoir or are maybe not familiar with it don't understand the difference between a kind of carefully crafted memoir and somebody's journal or somebody's diary, and might not understand how that writing is polished and is processed. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how long did it take you to turn your experiences and your sort of jotting, you know, notes in the journal into this book?
Yeah, I could talk about that probably at length. I think all good writers keep notes obsessively, and I wish I could say that I was one of those guys. I try to keep a notebook with me all the time, and it's a real discipline to pull it out and jot down what you're seeing and hearing. I'm always working on getting better at that. But the actual writing of the book, it took me, I would say, the better part of 4 years. I don't come from an academic tradition. I didn't go through a writing program at a university. But my for better or for worse, my process is revision. I obsessively revise this book for a long time. Literally, I would go back to the work I had done the day before, and I would revise from the beginning every time I sat down. So I was constantly retreading old ground. But it seems to work for me. I guess I need to backtrack a bit. I had no intention of this turning into a book, and I polished the journal for quite a long time, and I sent it around to some people that I admire. We in Michigan, we have a local poet and essayist named Thomas Lynch. I don't know if you're familiar with him.
I'm not.
He's nationally known, internationally known. He writes a lot about death and dying, and primarily a poet. But he read it and gave me some good criticism. But the one piece of advice that he gave me that I took to heart was that, yeah, this is good, but you really need a countervailing theme to almost a way to provide friction against what you've already written here about Flint, and only then did it occur to me, well, I need to set the Flint story off against the story of my family and my mother, and it was only by doing that, I think, that the book took on a life of its own and acquired my voice came through.
Did your work as a poet influence your nonfiction writing? The chapters seem to me, they're very short and kind of evocative. They read almost a little bit like flash fiction. They're poetic, I guess, for lack of a better word. Can you talk a little bit about maybe similarities and differences between the kind of writing you'd published before and working on this book?
Yeah. Again, I published a couple of books of poetry. I had done that before this, and the urge or the drive to write poetry certainly informed the writing of this book. I can say that the process was the same for me. I couldn't distinguish between sitting down to write poetry and sitting down to write this book. Although, you know, the format is totally different, and but I'm really drawn to imagery and a certain indirectness. And you know, I hope I achieved this, but I didn't want to tell people what to think. I didn't want to tell readers how to feel. I wanted to suggest things, and the hope would be that readers then would draw their own conclusions or find something in the book to trigger their own feelings, which is what I think I do with poetry.
I think it works. I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how you think it might work in teaching context. So, I teach medical students. Many of my colleagues and sort of professional associates are interested in history of medicine, in medical or health humanities. What do you think Sandpipe might be able to give an audience of healthcare workers? I'm thinking not just of physicians, but of public health professionals, nurses, EMTs, home health aides. Without being sort of prescriptive, right, or didactic, what might you hope that folks like that would get out of the book?
Yeah, well, I from the very beginning in going to Flint and even and in retrospect during my teaching career, I struggled with the idea of maintaining a professional distance from the people I was endeavoring to help, my students or the citizens in Flint, you know, maintaining a professional distance as opposed to getting caught up in my version of what it might be to save them. And, you know, I felt like my heart was in the right place. I was doing the right thing. But there's always that, I was always conscious of why am I really doing this? What am I really hoping to do here? Which I think it can keep a person from, even if their heart is in the right place, it can keep a person from seeing their, you know, patient or their student or, a person living in Flint as a human being in their own right and an individual in their own right. And there was always that tension there for me. I hope I landed on the right side of that more often than the wrong side. I know when I taught in my teaching career, there were some students that I became too invested in, and I mentioned this in the book, but it never did them any good, and it never did me any good. And likewise in Flint, it didn't take me long to realize that any notions, romantic notions I might have had going in that I'm going there, you know, I'm doing God's work, I'm helping these people. I was disabused of that almost right away. Certainly the Red Cross did very good work there, and I was a small part of that. But the people in Flint, you know, the citizens there they've been dealing with trauma and social injustice for decades and decades and decades. And the water crisis was just the latest the latest thing to come along, you know, just another example of being taken for granted by the powers that be.
Equanimity,
if you're getting back to the question, mm-hmm. developing equanimity in a sense that, you see people for who they are, and trying to find a balance between helping them, but not being paternalistic and not getting caught up in saving anybody.
In what ways does Standpipe work against expectations readers might have about memoirs that deal with death and dying? I'm thinking of books that are quite popular among, you know, doctor writers or in medical or health humanities programs, things like When Breath Becomes Air or the work of Atul Gawande. Death and dying are sort of bread and butter for medical humanists, unfortunately. In what ways does Standpipe kind of contribute to that genre, but work against it a little bit?
I can best answer that probably by talking about how my expectations changed. My mother didn't die suddenly. She died over the course of the better part of a year. And looking back now, I think when she first started to experience serious illness, I was already anticipating her death, even though she wasn't near death at that point. She was an older person. Death is inevitable, and I went. That was where I went. I went straight to that, trying to imagine what this was all about, and what it meant for the two of us. And I had certain expectations. I think that I developed during that year and a half of some kind of reconciliation between us, brought about by her death. In other words, this fanciful idea that her dying her death would bring us, bring us to a point of understanding that we had really diverged from over the years. And it brought me closer to her because she needed my help. And it put me in a frame of mind to really examine our relationship. But for the two of us, anything that I might have expected to get from, I shouldn't say get from, but anything I might have expected to come from her death, that didn't happen. There was no last minute reconciliation. There was no tidy summing up of our life together. And I wasn't entitled to that. You know, her death was her death, and it wasn't mine. And I was there to witness it. Fortunately, I had the good fortune to be there to witness it. But it was her own death, and I really. Looking back, it was naive of me to think that her death would afford us some kind of neat storybook summing up of all the things that had transpired to keep us apart over the years.
So there's sort of no big revelation.
But that was my fantasy. There would be a revelation. I read those books, yeah. Fiction,
yeah,
rife in fiction, and part of me, I think, expected that. And I'm not saying I was looking forward to it, but I was anticipating it, and somehow that would benefit both of us. It would ease her journey to whatever comes after. And ease my life as well. But, you know, that did not happen. And again, I'm repeating myself, but nor should it have happened. Her death was hers. And I was just happy that I could be there to witness it for whatever it was.
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you weave together. The blurb on the back of the book says, really sort of applauds your engagement with civic and familial trauma, and you really and weaves those two things together, civic and familial trauma. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about how you do that. It's hard to convey unless people read the book. So I would encourage our listeners to read the book. But if you could give them a kind of secondhand of what you were trying to do with that, that would be wonderful.
Well, I was trying to portray trauma in small in its smallest. Its smallest iterations, you know, in Flint, I would meet quite a few people every day, you know, my job, and I probably didn't make it clear earlier in the conversation. My job was to drive, in the Red Cross, they call it an emergency relief vehicle, but the acronym is an ERV, E-R-V. My job was to drive an ERV around town and deliver water to people who couldn't they couldn't pick up water at one of the water sites that the state had established all over the city. So they either they didn't have a car, or they couldn't drive, or they didn't have the means to get there. So my job was to bring the water to them. What I wanted to do was showcase. I wanted to portray the trauma that they were going through individually, as individuals, as mothers, fathers, grandparents, in a real small way. But I was at the same time wanted to portray the trauma that I had gone through growing up, and trauma comes in a lot of different packages. And I don't want to make a distinction between different kinds. Certainly the trauma that I went through was nothing compared to what the folks in Flint were going through, and nothing compared to a lot of people, but it was still trauma. And as a city, the city itself had gone through years of trauma, before the water crisis became the water crisis. And I wanted to try to portray all of it, in small ways and large, but I think maybe I was more successful at portraying the hallmarks of trauma writ small, if that makes sense.
I think so, because it is a very sort of a detailed, as you say, sort of poet's eye view of your experiences. It's also, I read Stan Pipe as being a sort of partly a report on this public health disaster in Flint, Michigan. So what did you see when you came there as a volunteer to help? Who did you meet? But also as a kind of critique of heroic narratives, especially sort of white savior type narratives in medicine and public health. Did I read it right? Was that one of the things that you intended for readers to glean from the book?
Yeah, that was always foremost in my mind. I'm white, late middle aged. Well, maybe I'm even elderly by now. I don't know. And it was never lost on me that I was going to a predominantly black city to lend a hand, to help out. And I was constantly asking myself, well, what am I really doing here? And how do I view myself in this context? And I very much wanted to address that in the book. I fought against that, the idea that I was, this good white guy showing up in Flint to right some kind of a wrong all the time. It quickly gets dispelled when you start meeting people and meeting people in their own homes and talking to people in their own homes. You know, the problem in Flint was a problem for the entire city, but it doesn't define the citizens individually. It doesn't define who they are. I ran into all kinds of people and with you know, real varied histories, and that probably helped me more than anything to get over this idea that I might be going there for the wrong reasons or going there with some kind of elevated view of my role.
So I think this theme, at least the way I read the book, was that this theme kind of comes into play in both the book's title and conclusion. And I usually ask about the title first, but because your title is also in your conclusion, I kind of saved this question for last. Could you tell us a little bit about where the book's title came from? And then as much as you want to say about the end of the book, without giving too much away.
Yeah, well, the title came to me early on. I mean, well, it came to me while I was in Flint, actually. I'm not sure where it comes from. I'm never sure where my ideas come from, but I began. You know, a standpipe is, if you look it up, it's really literally a pipe coming out of the ground to bring water in a communal way to people who we're all dependent on it. And it, to me, it was a stark image of what the Red Cross was doing in Flint. And you know, a standpipe itself, in my view, speaks for itself. It's nothing else. It's its own statement, I suppose, on purpose. And you know, I guess one could choose to interpret it in different ways and see it as a metaphor. But to me, it was just a real stark statement of purpose for what was happening in Flint. And the end of the book, and I guess I won't say, I don't want to, well, there's really no ending to give away, but I will say this, it became apparent to me in my time in Flint. Drew, the reason I it ended for me was the Red Cross, their mission is to provide emergency relief in the wake of a natural disaster, and Flint had ceased to be. It sounds odd to say, but it had ceased to be an emergency. Although if you're living there, it's an emergency. But in the Red Cross's eyes, it had ceased to be an emergency, and the state of Michigan took over from them to provide water. And so I was a Red Cross volunteer, so my time ended. It had a definite shelf life. But I became increasingly aware as my time drew to a close, that as important as it was to deliver water, that was the mission. The real mission, the real goal was just for me. Was compassion and seeing people for who they were, and sort of letting go of all my preconceived notions and expectations, and being mindful of my time there and the people I met and their own stories, their individual stories.
Well, Dave, the book sort of does, I think it does portray the folks you met in a sensitive and observant way. We've taken up a lot of your time. I wondered, it's now time for our traditional final question, which is, what are you working on now?
I'm a fan of Richard Ford. He's a novelist. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Mm-hmm. He's primarily a novelist, but a few years ago he published a memoir called Between Them, and it really had an effect on me. He writes about his parents. He was an only child. And it wasn't a dramatic upbringing, you know. Things certainly happened in their family that were significant, but it wasn't a lurid tell-all. His parents were just typical people in the Midwest trying to get by. But it really had an effect on me, and so right now I talk a lot about my mother and standpipe, and I've been thinking a lot about my father. To me, family is a never ending well of interest. I think families are the basis of a lot of good fiction, but in terms of memoir, I've been looking more at my father, and I don't really have a good idea yet, but I'm conceiving of some sort of portrait of him in writing that might be a combination of poetry, essay, fiction and nonfiction as well. There's a lot I don't know about him, and I want to create my own version that might be true. As close as I can get to who he was as a man. So anyway, that's what I'm working on now. And I'm always writing poetry. I write every day.
Well, Dave, that sounds like a wonderful project. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show and share your work with us today.
And thank you, Claire. I really appreciate it.